Started. So yesterday, at the end of the last lecture, we kind of reminded ourselves of why just taking a naive derivative, partial derivative, of anything other than a scalar just didn't work, because a vector or covectors or tensors have transformation. They transform if you change your coordinates. And so if you just take a partial derivative, you pick up not only derivatives of the vector, but also some part which is telling you about how the vector changes under coordinate transformations, at least looking at it from the sort of classical or physics type language point of view. So I said there were different ways of getting rid of that non-covariant part of the transformation. We noted that it was symmetric, because partial differentiation was symmetric. And so one way of getting rid of this piece is to anti-symmetrize a derivative. So that'll be the first thing that we do today, which is called the exterior derivative, or D. So that's the D up there. And the other way of doing it is to note that by taking a sort of partial derivative, d by dx mu, what you're kind of trying to do is take a very general derivative in all the directions in the manifold at once and sort of say how things are changing in different directions. And so another way of solving the problem is by, instead of saying I'm going to try and take a general derivative, is to take a derivative with respect to some specific direction in the manifold, in a way which I'm going to have to make precise, of course, and that's what the Lie derivative is. So those are the two derivatives that we're going to look at this morning. So let's start with D. So the exterior derivative is a completely anti-symmetric derivative. So we're going to start out by just doing something simple on an object that we know, then we'll take a step back and try and generalize it and think about what it is more in abstract. So what this means is that if we have a covector, getting ahead of myself there, it means that if you look at its components in any basis and swap the order of them, you get a minus sign. So that's what it means, anti-symmetric. So we're going to look at it first for a covector. So just a small comment is that because your differentiation inherently, you know, when you took a partial derivative, if you think about where the index is, it's an inherently covariant object, not contravariant. It means that you really want to be acting with this D on covectors. Yep.
I was still thinking about the derivative as the change of something in some way, because I don't see...
I haven't defined it yet. I'm just saying this is what it means, you know. For having something anti-symmetric, I'm just sort of emphasizing it means that if you swap the indices, you've got to get a minus sign. So in fact, if I write it down in components, what it means is about to define it. So that's how you define it. Sorry, I didn't mean that was what it was. I just said that's what it should have as a property, anti-symmetry. So So that's what it is for covectors, right? So, I mean, that doesn't look anything too dramatic, but from our previous calculation, when we looked at what happened to partial derivatives of vectors, so if we compare it to that expression that I wrote down right at the end of yesterday's lecture, you can see that by anti-symmetrizing on the differentiation, we've got rid of the non-covariant part. So this expression that I've written down does transform as a tensor, even though it's only got these partial derivatives in it. So so that's just on covectors. That's not really very useful, is it? If all we can do is differentiate a single object in our whole tensor algebra. So we want to be able to use this derivative on a range of different objects. So if we try and go up in rank, so if we look, say we want not just a covector, but some second rank covariant tensor, you can see that if you want to have something completely anti-symmetric, there's no sense in taking a derivative of a symmetric object. So because the differentiation has to be completely anti-symmetric, what it acts on has also got to be completely anti-symmetric. So these, yeah?
Well, what it acts on is, does it need to be completely anti-symmetric, or does it need to have a term which is completely anti-symmetric?
No, it has to be completely anti-symmetric, because if you sort of take what we did at the very end of last lecture, where we looked at, I mean, it was a vector rather than some general covariant tensor, but the principle was, we were taking a partial derivative of a geometric object. We looked at a coordinate transformation. So when you do a coordinate transformation of, say, a completely covariant object, you kind of pick up this whole stack of transformation matrices. So when you take the partial derivative, you've got one that acts on the object itself, plus a whole little list of derivatives of your transformation matrix. So those are those dx, dy by dx, dx. So you pick up a whole stack of them, and you need to be able to get rid of every single one of those terms. So every single one of those second derivatives has got to end up being anti-symmetrized. So you must completely anti-symmetrize your derivative, as we'll see when I write down the general form. And so if you started off with something that wasn't completely anti-symmetric, it would be like having extra, if you then sort of just wrote down a completely anti-symmetrized derivative, you would be killing off the non-anti-symmetric information in the original object, which is not, so, but that means that there's sort of physical information in there that you've just lost, you've thrown away, and it's not because you've taken the derivative. So this, I mean, that's trying to put it in more of a physicist language, but basically, as we'll build up what we mean by these anti-symmetric tensors, which are called forms, and then the way the exterior derivative is defined, which is actually defined on these anti-symmetric objects, you'll see that it doesn't really make sense otherwise. So it's kind of one of those things that may make more sense in a bit of time. So these completely anti-symmetric objects are called forms, and they crop up all over the place in differential geometry and relativity. Also, you know, in gauge theories, you end up having a lot of forms, so they're really quite important. And you build them up from anti-symmetric tensor products. So you say that A wedge B is defined as A tensor B minus B tensor A. So just like you define tensors by building them up, taking tensor products of vectors or covectors, and then that's your sort of basis for your tensor algebra. Your exterior algebra is built up from this wedge product, which is simply like a tensor product, but anti-symmetrizing. So in components, so fairly the obvious thing. You're just taking like a tensor product, but anti-symmetrizing. So in general, sort of easiest to write it down in components, but if you have a P form, wedge it with a Q form, so let me just check that you've seen the notation of square brackets and curly brackets. Yes? Means anti-symmetry. So in other words, you take all permutations of the indices with a plus or minus sign.
In this notation, the square bracket doesn't mean any 1/1.
It does. Yes, it does, which is precisely what this P plus Q factorial is kind of meant to cancel. Yep. So it's basically, that's meant to sort of cancel that combinatorial factor in the anti-symmetrization. But then because you still have this, you know, every time you just permute just the A's or just the B's, you've got exactly the same object. You need to divide by these other combinatorial factors so that what you end up with are really just the honest to God different combinations of the indices there. So that's anyway, I'll just put it on this board that's hard to see just so that it is clear. So this wedge product is not a commutative product. It's obviously anti-commutative on one forms, but in, again, in general, if you try and swap a P form and a Q form, you can sort of see that you've got to kind of rustle all of these B indices through the A ones. Each time you swap a pair of indices, you get a minus sign. There's Q of them that have got to be pulled through P, and so you get a minus to the PQ. So, for example, if you were taking two two forms, the wedge product, then and swapped them, you wouldn't get a minus sign. I realize, of course, that I've used P to represent a general point on the manifold, and if I try and make a difference in handwriting between a capital P and a little p, it'll all go south. So I'll say now it's lambda Q of M, so Q has replaced P as our point on the manifold. So we denote this space of P forms really just as lambda to the P, and it's then we can, of course, take the bundle by taking the sets of the of the lambda p's at every point on the manifold. So the first thing to notice is, well, I know it's early in the morning, but I'll ask you, can I make p as big as I want? I think. Now I've got some no's. Good. Right. So the that's correct. Why can't I make P big? Yeah, exactly. So I can't go any bigger than the dimension of the space. Again, if you think about it in terms of these permutations, I've got an n-dimensional manifold. I've only got n linearly independent directions that I can take. Once I go beyond n, from the point of view of this expression, then there will always be a repetition here in terms of choice of direction. So one of these, one of the directions of the form, of the forms, or if I think about it as trying to take a wedge product of n plus one forms, if I've got n plus 1 covectors, one of those covectors will always be expressible as a sum of all the others by linear dependence. So I know the dimension of the manifold's n. If I've got n plus 1 vectors or covectors, I always write it as a sum of all the others. And so that means that when I try and anti-symmetrize a product, I'll always get 0. So P has to be less than or equal to n. Moreover, if I think about n forms, actually, there's only one sort of linearly independent n form. And it's always going to be proportional to the Levi-Civita symbol. So remember, this is plus or minus 1 according to whether A1 to AN is an odd or even permutation of 1 to N. Yeah. So I think you know, it's normally when you first see this, it's okay. Oh, good. When you first see this, it's in the context of R cubed, and it's like epsilon ijk. And that's normally where you first meet this thing. So it's exactly the same thing, but instead it's got N indices. Strictly speaking, I'm just going to put this as a sort of semi an aside, but we will get back to it later. This isn't really a tensor, it's what's called a tensor density, which means that if you do a coordinate transformation, you get a factor of the determinant, the Jacobian, when you take the transformation. That's actually just comes, it is the definition of determinant. So, yeah, I guess it might be called that. Yeah, that's probably true. Generally, when you say density, it just means that there's sort of a weight associated with a transformation. So in this case, if you have a coordinate transformation, so if I just stick to 4D for the moment, for example, you would have so this would be if it was, that would be what you would expect if a tensor, right? But of course, I know that this particular object here is actually the determinant of dx by dx primed. And so what it means is that under a coordinate transformation, you're getting a factor of the determinant of the transformation coming in. So if we have a metric, though, we can construct a sort of bona fide tensor, which I'm going to denote by curly epsilon. And again, I'll just for ease do it in four dimensions. You've seen this, of course, subject root det modulus of the determinant of the metric. Yeah.
Tensor density completely coordinate independent. I mean,
in this case, no, because if you do, I mean, I suppose, no, it's a good question, so I'm not 100% sure. I'm just talking off the top of my head here. But if you're doing a coordinate transformation, this sort of the density part of it, right, is telling you about what it does under the coordinate transformation. And so what the intuition here to have is that this thing is actually the volume element. So when you take, say, A wedge B, you're thinking of it, if you like, I don't know, Mrs. Thorne and Wheeler have these lovely pictures of sort of boxes and what have you. You should think about A wedge B as representing a sort of a little area, a little unit, a little diamond of area. And A wedge B wedge C would be thinking of a sort of little box of volume and so on and so forth. And so, in a sense, what this particular symbol, I'm introducing it because it's something that, you know, we will be using, and I thought, you know, while we're doing forms, I'll just mention it. So this symbol is actually, in some ways, encoding something about what happens to volumes. So, yeah?
I don't know, but naively to me, it looks like you're saying the Jacobian is equal to 1.
No, I didn't mean to say that, did I? So what I did here was if, so this first line would have been true if this transformed as a tensor. Yep. So this would be if a tensor. Which, as you correctly point out, is telling us that this thing would have to be 1, okay? So in reality, it doesn't transform that way. What it transforms is you've got to take a factor of the dx prime by dx in order to get the right expression. So that's the density bit. It's not transforming like a tensor. You've got to take the normal tensor transformation rules plus this extra determinant. Thanks. I was a bit foggy there. However, if you now look at this expression, the determinant of the metric under a coordinate transformation, GAB, our determinant of the metric gets a factor of the square of dx by dx prime. So root g is also a tensor density, although it's a scalar, it's a scalar density. And so you can see that because the epsilon symbol transforms with dx prime by dx, and root g transforms with dx by dx prime, the combination is invariant, not a density. So just before leaving forms, I mean, kind of badge this because we'll be coming back to this. This epsilon, once we have a metric, we can relate these different spaces of forms.
Yeah.
There is that question somewhere. So this is known as Hodge duality. We're taking the star of a form. And just so once you actually start with this exterior algebra, and given you've got a metric which allows you to sort of hop between different different anti-symmetric spaces, then you see you can actually build up quite a bit of information. And it turns out that by looking at relations between these different spaces, the wedge product spaces, tells you quite a bit about the underlying manifold. So some of the topology of the manifold kind of gets encoded in the properties of these spaces, and that's actually a whole interesting story. So let me get back to the exterior derivative, though. So back to D. So what we're going to do to get, just we just need to first, I've told you what D is for one forms, but what we always do with differentiation actually first is to just say what it is on functions, and every single derivative pretty much that you've come along is just partial differentiation on functions, and D is no different. So D acting on a function says just take a partial derivative. So this would be in a coordinate basis. Then D in general is defined as a map from lambda p to lambda p plus 1. So that, if you like. So it takes you from a p form to a p plus 1 form. So it's a derivation. Such that it reduces to partial differentiation on functions and also is Leibnizian. And it's a linear map. In other words, if you just multiply one of your forms by a constant, or the whole thing just gets multiplied by a constant. So these sort of three statements are sufficient to actually pin down precisely what D is. And so in components, it is, as I advertised, a completely anti-symmetric derivative. And so just to sort of emphasize, I've said Leibnizian. Normally in Leibnizian, you just say d of ab would be dA times b plus dB times a. Of course, we've got to be a bit more careful here because we've got this anti-symmetrization. So what it really means is if I'm taking a p-form wedged with a q-form and I then take the exterior derivative, then I first act on the p-form. But then I've got to pull D all the way through A to act on B. And so that's going to give me minus 1 to the P A wedge DB. So you can sort of think of D as being a bit like a form in its own right, except it isn't really, it's an operator, it's a differential operator, so it has to act on something. But it's a bit like a one form. So you can sort of think of it in that way if you want to just figure out what, you know, what the right sign factor is to put in there. So you're actually, you already know a bit about forms anyway, even if, well, some of you may in any case, because you may have done them. But let's just look at an example about forms that you know. So electromagnetism is really a theory about forms. Your electromagnetic gauge potential, A mu, in four dimensions, is a one form, it's a covector. I've got my signs right. So any covector is a one form. And then the Maxwell field, F, is just dA. So F mu nu is d mu A nu minus d nu A mu. So if I write it as a matrix, I've got everything right there. So that is the field strength. So it's simply the field strength, the Maxwell field strength, is a two form. And so B here, as we know, is curl A. And so in terms of the language that we've just done, this, if I think of this, in terms of that tensor algebra of R cubed, this would be saying that B was equal to star dA. Okay? Because in three dimensions, the vector potential is, you can think of it as a one form. You take D of it, you get a two form. Then take the dual of that, the star, that changes a p-form into an n minus p-form. So in three dimensions, changes a two-form into a one-form. And a one-form, really, if you're in flat R cubed, vectors and covectors are essentially the same. And so that's what the magnetic... So curl is really just star d in R cubed. So you can kind of go back to all the sort of first time you did vector algebra and sort of see how it slots in to this slightly more general way of writing things. So in this case, we automatically get half of Maxwell's equations, df equals zero, because d squared is zero. D of D always vanishes, because if we go back to our coordinate definition of the exterior derivative, it's defined as antisymmetric partial differentiation, and partial differentiation commutes. So D squared is zero. And then similarly, gauge invariance. is also guaranteed by the same principle. So if we take A goes to A plus D lambda, then dA goes to dA plus D squared lambda, which is just dA. So we can change our gauge field by the derivative of any function, and it doesn't change the electromagnetic field. And then it's a U1 gauge theory. Because we can couple to scalars. So that's something familiar. It's electromagnetism, but we can also play the game with higher dimensional forms. Why not? We can do it for A mu. Why don't we try and look at higher dimensional forms? So if we, for example, took a 2 form, then we would have gauge invariance would be B mu nu goes to B mu nu plus, say, D mu omega nu minus D mu omega mu. So that's B goes to B plus D omega. And then our field strength, H, which would be dB, is just all the independent combinations of the derivatives of B. So this example, of course, crops up in string theory because A mu corresponds to what you would say a point particle is. So you have a world line, which kind of x dot mu couples to A mu, if you were thinking about it sort of classically, as just charged particles. And so B mu nu sort of corresponds to a line source. So you've, in this case, you've got an x dot mu and an x prime mu, which you contract with B mu nu. So that's why it sources this B mu nu. And you can carry on, take higher. I mean, in 4 dimensions, these are the only two things that kind of make sense. Because when you take A, take its field strength, you get a 2 form, which is dual to a 2 form. You've got B, take its field strength, you get a 3 form, but a 3 form is dual to a 1 form. And so that's really just like saying that it's sort of essentially the degrees of freedom of a scalar. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about forms. So I'll start on the Lie derivative. So what the Lie derivative does, all of this here has been taking a sort of general derivative, but increasing the rank of a tensor or a form. But the Lie derivative takes a vector and gives you a vector, but it's taking a derivative along a vector field. So If you think about some vector field u, remember vectors are tangents to curves, and so you can imagine a set of curves locally to which u is tangent. So this is the sort of picture. Here, got my point P. Here, got another point, sort of P plus delta P, I'm going to call it. I've got another vector field V. And this changes, obviously, as I move around the manifold. So my vector field may point in this direction here, points in a different direction once I've got to P plus delta P, and I'm obviously exaggerating what's going on here. So if you were taking a covariant derivative, what you would do is you'd sort of slide this V up to this other point in a very general way. But there's another way of moving V from P, this V naught, from P to P plus delta P. And that is by using, so this vector field U here, you can see that what it's doing locally, it's giving you a way of shifting your manifold around. So you can shift from one point to another, if you like, by kind of sliding along these curves that define U. So strictly speaking, what U is doing is providing a way of mapping the manifold back onto itself locally. You can sort of think of it as either sort of actively sort of shifting, you know, moving your manifold, giving a map from itself to itself, or you could just think of it as a coordinate transformation. So I'm thinking here that my P, remember this curve is parameterized by T. So my P is at T naught. My P plus delta P is at T naught plus delta T. So you can think of this as a coordinate transformation in essence, that if I change coordinates using my U vector field, then that gives me a means of mapping my vector to a new, my V naught, mapping it to P plus delta P. So think of this either as a new chart or sliding your manifold, if you like. I'm trying to shortcut telling you about maps on manifolds here. So this V star is therefore, because it's a vector, it transforms contravariantly. So it's going to be d xt by dx naught. plus the derivative of u. And so now what we can do is use our normal definition of derivative to define this derivative by formed by sliding along u. Or an analogy of the usual definition of the derivative. So the way we write this is we use a curly L, that's the lead derivative, with respect to u of v, so what we're doing is we're saying that we're going to take the difference of the vector at p plus delta p compared to the vector at p pushed forward to p plus delta p. So if I now put that in, v of t plus delta t is v at x naught mu plus delta t u mu, which is v at x naught plus delta t u dot partial derivative of v. So if I put that in using here, that's v star, this is v at t plus delta t. You can see that the v naughts cancel, and what I end up with is u dot partial v minus v dot partial u. So that's a lead derivative of a vector. So I can do the same for a general tensor by using the same steps. For a general tensor, I take my object at t plus delta t and subtract off what I would get from the object at t naught pushed forward or taken using this coordinate transformation to t naught plus delta t. So for a covector, the only thing to notice is the sign there. So it's a minus sign if it's a vector index, it's a plus sign if it's a covector index. So I just want to write a little bit more information about the lead derivative. So it's sort of a bit of an obvious, yeah.
So if we want to get a plus sign, we need to put in the definition of V star a minus sign in the middle here. So how, what
so there's two ways you can convince yourself that it's a plus sign. One way is to notice that the lead derivative acting on a scalar just reduces to a partial derivative along U. And so if you took, you know, the scalar product, if you like, the product of a covector with a vector, that means that it's got to vanish. So that's one way of getting the plus sign. But if you actually look at, or go, if you go through, and if you sort of actually go through the coordinate transformations, you'll also see that it works. So have a go. If you can't see it, come and see me and we can maybe go through it sort of offline. So so acting on vectors, what you've actually got, you get a vector when you act with the lead derivative, and what you've actually got is an, yes? Yes. There's, well, a sort of glib way of putting it would be there's no other way, because you've got to have a downstairs index on the omega and you've got to have an upstairs index on the U, because one is a covector, the other is a vector, and I don't have a metric. So that's a glib way of putting it. Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's clear what the coordinate independent, the nice expression is.
I'll
write
it down, yeah.
Oh, okay. But for a covector, what? Okay, are you
from the... No, so, for the vector, what it does is another way of writing sort of Lie U of V is saying that it is, in fact, what's called the Lie bracket, because that is then defined via UV acting on a function. Remember, vectors were maps from functions, you know, they were differential operators acting on functions. So that's UV minus VU of F. And so if you wrote that down in coordinates, you would see that that in fact gave exactly the same result. So I think the coordinate, no, it's, I'm trying to sort of think of an answer to your question. I mean, the way that I've defined it, I've tried to avoid, I didn't want to go in to full detail about diffeomorphisms, about maps between manifolds, because that would have also taken some extra time. But I was trying to sort of get the essence of it across about what you were doing when you were taking objects from P and moving them to P plus delta P. You've got to get around the fact that these two tangent spaces at the different points are different. When you do covariant differentiation, which we'll just be very briefly reviewing tomorrow, you do that via putting a connection on the tangent bundle. So the connection is a way of linking together the tangent spaces at each point. It's general, it's not pinned to a particular direction, but it's also kind of specific in the sense that you choose a way to link the tangent spaces together. So that's covariant differentiation. You connect the different tangent spaces. Here, the way that you're linking the tangent spaces together is by saying that you are making a map between a bit of the manifold here. So you're taking a bit of the manifold here and you're moving it up to a bit round there by sliding it along this U vector field. So that gives you a way of mapping between between the manifolds. And so that's how you, that is actually a geometric concept, this idea of maps. So that's the best answer I think I can give in real time, but I'm very happy to go over it in a bit more detail offline, okay? And I better stop because I've run over.